Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. All right. Play a little party game with me. I want to see if people can guess this word I'm thinking of based on a couple of clues.
So it's the space all around us. It's what we want to protect when we recycle. It's what we care about on Earth Day. It's
our environment.
The environment.
Environment.
Everybody got it. Quickly. I'm sure you did too. But using this word in this way is still pretty new.
This modern understanding of what we now mean by environment is certainly almost totally post-Second World War.
That's historian Sverker Sörlin. He's one of the authors of a new book, The Environment, A History of an Idea. He says before the 1940s, environment was used only as a way to describe surroundings, like the space around a farm. After World War II and the atomic bomb, people were much more aware of the destruction humans could bring. This was also a period of rebuilding and prosperity. Bigger cars, fully stocked refrigerators. There was more and more concern about how much humans were using up resources and impacting nature.
Throughout our land, the once beautiful forests have become scenes of desolation. The timber is gone, and so is the wild game which once was sheltered beneath its shade.
People started talking about various problems, like erosion was a big issue after the war. Also overfishing.
Overpopulation, but all as separate topics. Then scientists like American ornithologist William Vogt started using the word environment to connect all of these problems, to show how they were related.
So environment was about nature becoming worse and worse, in a sense.
Sverker says bringing all of these different issues together under one umbrella term, environment, as the natural space changed by humans, made a huge difference.
The word was enormously important because it served as the kind of unifying thought, an idea which was common currency.
Global scientific organizations launched research projects on the environment. Politicians started talking about it. People got involved on the ground.
So environmentalism, in the modern understanding as these social movements, could also start growing once there was an environment to be environmentalistic about.
One word helped spawn a global movement. A whole new way of thinking about an intricate system of cause and effect. Words, names, they shape how we think about an issue, how we approach it, how much we care about it. On today's show, a look at what we call things and why it matters. Is something a defect or a difference? Is it a compliment or harmful comment? Also, scientists tell us which terms we use incorrectly and why it drives them nuts. Let's start with a word, or a title in this case, that recently came up when I was interviewing two podcast hosts.
My name is Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
Dr. Sydney McElroy. I always
make
a joke.
I'm Dr. Sydney McElroy.
Thank you. It lends our podcast an air of credibility.
They host a podcast called Sawbones. Sydney is a physician, an MD, and her husband Justin was making sure she got credited with the doctor title. It made us think about who we should call doctor and why. Alan Yu has more.
Adam Rubin is a molecular biologist. He has a PhD, and there was this one time when he made a conscious choice to refer to himself as Dr. Rubin.
I think I called myself doctor in the email signature to an airline complaining about how they messed up a flight and we had to spend a night in some city and I was trying to get a refund for our hotel bill. So I signed the email Dr. Rubin. And I know that's kind of an icky thing to do, but I have heard that you get better service when you use the term doctor?
It kind of worked. He got his refund after 3 months.
And it's not outright wrong, and the world should forgive me.
Adam has been thinking about this whole doctor honorific thing for a while. He polled his friends and acquaintances with PhDs on Facebook and Twitter about whether or not they call themselves doctor. Some said yes, they've earned it. Others said, no, it seems a little pretentious.
A surprising number of people all had the same concern about using the term doctor if they were going to be on an airplane when somebody needs a doctor.
This sort of happened to Adam several years ago, but he was on the ground. Besides being a biologist, he's also a writer and comedian. And this one time, Adam was at a Story Collider storytelling event.
Where I was performing in a show for mostly graduate students and people who'd been to graduate school. And somebody actually had a medical emergency in the middle of the show. He fainted and needed an ambulance.
The evening was recorded, so they caught this moment on tape.
He said, well, what if you try the drug in higher concentrations?
Hey, this guy needs medical help.
Oh.
This guy's passing out. Anybody doctor?
Adam is not that kind of doctor. Some EMTs helped the guy, and he was okay in the end. And the show went on.
So that's a first. I hope you guys noticed what happened, too, that when someone said, is anyone here a doctor, a room full of, like, 200 PhDs all looked at each other like, no, I kind of, but... I'm a doctor of astrophysics. No, it's not the same thing.
Adam wrote about his social media poll for the journal Science. He heard from female engineers with PhDs who said they are underrepresented in their field. They said they feel like they need to put doctor in front of their names to get the same respect that male engineers get. Beth Linus also earned a PhD and would like to get a little respect. She's an epidemiologist.
Someone comes up to the street and says hello to me, and they can address me as Beth. But if I'm being called upon for my background in infectious disease epidemiology or digital health, which is the other area that I study, you know, I think I should be recognized as Dr. Beth Linus.
I'd be happy to call her Dr. Beth Linus, but that's not how we handle it on our show. More on that later. I wanted to speak to Beth because she wrote a commentary about the congressional hearings with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and research psychologist Christine Blasey Ford, who accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were in high school.
We will hear from two witnesses, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. Thanks, of course, to Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh.
There was a lot of chatter online and on Twitter about how in written media, she wasn't being addressed as Dr. Ford. I started noticing it in other publications, in other outlets.
And university professor Christine Blasey Ford,
one of the lawyers for Christine Blasey Ford.
Christine Blasey Ford's allegations of sexual assault.
NPR got complaints about that. The ombudsman explained that like many media outlets, NPR follows the Associated Press stylebook, which says, if someone practices medicine, NPR calls them doctor. If it's someone with a PhD, it's up to the individual media outlet. On the radio, we don't have a lot of time, and every word counts. Saying doctor can be a little vague, so on The Pulse, our policy is to introduce someone as an epidemiologist or a pediatrician or be clear about whatever their expertise is. Beth says her concern comes from a real issue of representation.
There are a lot of women, and particularly women of color, that really struggle to make their way in science and stay in science. And we face a lot of obstacles, and I think it's important for women also to be recognized.
There's a study that backs her up. Researchers found that male doctors introduce their male colleagues as doctor around 70% of the time, but introduce their female colleagues as doctor a little less than half the time. Beth is calling on media outlets to refer to people with PhDs as doctor, in particular if we're interviewing them about their area of expertise. She says if we do it right, it shouldn't be that hard to tell who is the kind of doctor who can help you when someone needs an ambulance. So she's made her case to media outlets.
This is a way to inform and help educate. And so I was a little bit surprised to see that a mission such as NPR's was not sort of following suit and leading the way and showing the way that it should be done.
Covering health and science means we talk to quite a few people with PhDs and MDs. So I decided to see how we've been doing following our own rule about who gets to be called doctor.
regular Pulse contributor Dr. Bethany Brookshire,
Dr. Arthur Evans,
Dr. Frederick Bertley, sociologist Dr. Liberty Barnes, Dr. Peter Gearhart.
That list included a mixed bag of PhDs and MDs who somehow got the honorific doctor. We have not always been consistent. We are working to do better.
And that was Alan Yu reporting. We're talking about what we call things and why it matters. For people who stutter, little things like ordering a cup of coffee can be exhausting. Sentences take longer to say, sometimes much longer, and people aren't always patient. So it seems like trying to get rid of your stutter would be really important, but not everybody's on board with that idea. Should we stop calling stuttering a speech impediment? Barry Yeoman has more.
When I'm locked in my bedroom, alone and relaxed, recording narration for the radio, I pretty much sound like this. One word flows from the next, like many of you speak every day. But in the wild, when I'm out interviewing folks, I often sound more like this.
You catch. Oysters, right?
Yes, sir.
What's your name?
I know what I want to say and how to articulate the sounds. But when I try to talk, my face clenches and the words come out in repetitive machine gun bursts or dissolve into silence. Stuttering is more than the audible symptoms. It's often coupled with shame and isolation. My friend Emma Alpern speaks for many of us who stutter when she describes her childhood.
Whenever I blew out a candle on the birthday cake or made a wish in a fountain or anything like that, I always made the same wish, which was to not stutter anymore. So it was just my constant overarching goal in speech therapy and just in life in general is to not stutter.
Compounding the distress for me was the unknowability of stuttering. It was a scientific black hole for much of my life. That's now changing. Researchers are untangling both the genetics and the brain chemistry of people who stutter. They've made progress in drug development, looking at medications that might alter that chemistry and reduce the stuttering. Many of my peers who stutter are excited about this. From the time we were children, we were taught that stuttering would hold us back in life and that the only way forward was not to stutter. That's why there's a persistent hope for some breakthrough that will bring us a cure. But some of us, including myself, believe we should rethink the assumption that stuttering is a defect that needs to be eradicated. I wanted to talk with others who share this view. So on a Sunday morning, I go to a conference in New York sponsored by a group called NYC Stutters. An actor named Mark Winsky sets the tone for the day. He gathers us into a circle. Some of us feel at home here, safe among friends. Others are new and nervous. Mark tells us that, no matter why we came and how we're feeling.
It's all right. There are no judgments.
Mark asks for volunteers to start improvising movements and sounds. Then he invites the rest of us to join in with our own sounds. As people who grew up hating how we talked, it's a treat to have fun with our voices.
And one by one, as soon as you feel the impulse to jump in. Follow the impulse. If you feel it, go. Change it up too. A can be a leg.
Then we settle into the conversation. This is a room full of people who have virtually nothing in common but our stutters. There are people who long for the cure. Their lives have been hard, and they just want their stutters to go away. And there are others, like my friend Chris, who have a different vision.
My name is Chris Constantino. I'm an assistant professor in communication sciences and disorders at Florida State University.
Chris is one of the speakers at the conference. He wrote a journal article suggesting that people who stutter should embrace an idea called neurodiversity. The theory is that humans have natural variations in how our brains work and that we should honor many of those differences rather than labeling them pathologies, problems. The term originated in the autism community, but many groups have championed similar ideas. For example, some deaf people have rejected cochlear implants, which make it possible for them to interpret sound. They say that deafness is a culture worth preserving, and gay and lesbian activists led the charge against therapies aimed at turning people straight. For those who stutter, Neurodiversity doesn't just mean tolerating our speech patterns. Rather, it means viewing stuttering as an advantage. For example, as something that can bring people closer by encouraging honest conversations.
How I like to see stuttering is it's as if we're temporarily stripped of our clothing, right? We're temporarily naked, and we don't have control over when we're forced to be vulnerable. However, the more time you spend defenseless with others, the more chances you have to connect deeply with somebody, because they've seen you and they've seen all of you, and all they need to do is reciprocate. All they need to do is strip down too. And by stuttering, we give them that opportunity.
Emma Alpern, my friend who spent so much of her childhood wishing for a cure, helped organize the New York conference. She says events like this have helped shift her priorities.
I really don't want to begrudge any stutterer for wanting to not stutter. It's very difficult. I get it. To me, it feels a little bit eugenic. I don't like the idea of us being wiped out. I mean, I found an incredible community, and stuttering has brought a lot of meaning to my life. Maybe what I really want to say is that I want us to be having deeper conversations about stuttering, and I think it's hard to have them when we are simultaneously putting our resources toward a cure.
I see Emma's point. The country's main organization for people who stutter has the word cure in its vision statement. That makes it harder to talk about the value of stuttering. And that conflict can hit you on a personal level, too. Trying not to stutter can feel like full-time work. During the 20 years I went to speech therapy, there were all these homework assignments that took hours each week. I would call telephone operators and hotel reservation lines, practicing the techniques I had learned and hoping not to stumble. But in a 24-hour day, you can only devote so much energy to thinking about how you talk. When I quit seeking fluency, it freed me up to shift that energy elsewhere. Some of my friends have had similar experiences. Take George DeQuilla, an engineer at the investment bank Goldman Sachs. He's a snazzy guy, cool glasses, hair just right. His smile is intense. So is his stutter, but he doesn't shrink away from it. He says this was not always the case.
Yeah, so as a child, probably up until I was 28, yes, I would have just wanted to get rid of it, like, as quickly as I could.
It took both a speech therapist and a counselor to convince George to rethink his fluency quest. By the time he joined Goldman Sachs in 2015, at the age of 31, he was starting to think of his stutter as an asset, a challenge that toughened him for the competitive world of Wall Street.
Goldman is a very intense culture of some really smart and really driven people. What I only understood once I came here was that my stuttering journey was so damn tough that really gave me that gift of that really unrelenting drive.
I met George at his New York office building. From the 36th floor, we had a sweeping view across the Hudson River to the Statue of Liberty. As we sat down to talk, his colleague, attorney Vanessa Kelly Smith, joined us. Vanessa identifies as deaf. She first met George over coffee in 2017.
Our stories were very, very similar in that we had spent a significant portion of our adult life not really comfortable with our disability or fully inhabiting it.
Right.
And I saw George as just someone who was just incredibly comfortable in his skin. We had very similar visions of what we wanted to do with our advocacy, which is to reframe how disability is seen, and to talk more about the strengths that come from having a disability.
One of George's goals is to help others navigate the corporate job market. He's organized mock job interview days for people who stutter. George's colleagues went through a training. They learned the science of stuttering, how people manage it, and how to listen respectfully.
So, like, the point of the day was interviews, but it was really more like tearing down like the wall, all that I know, that all that I like used to have of just, I was absolutely scared. So that inside, like the walls of a company, that there wouldn't be any acceptance of my stuttering, which was not true.
George says he was afraid that people wouldn't take the time to listen. He was wrong. They were patient, and they valued him. A few months after his hire, George was promoted to vice president. Leaving his office, I thought about what stuttering has given me. Like George, I have that unrelenting drive, the resolve to prove myself by succeeding professionally. My conversations are more intimate because of my stutter, and I have a community that embodies that drive and that intimacy. With all those gains, it's hard these days to think of my stutter as a defect.
That was Barry Yeoman reporting. We're talking about what we call things and why it matters. Here's a word we've used a lot recently on the news, in political debates, and even in obituaries: addiction. Nearly 200 people die every day in the U.S. from drug overdoses. We used to talk about addiction as a sign of moral weakness or criminal behavior that needs to be punished. But now people living with addiction, advocates, politicians, and even police are calling it a brain disease, a disease that requires medical treatment and care. But what does it mean to call addiction a brain disease? And why are some challenging this term? Joel Wolfram set out to understand this better, and he begins his story in a community that's been hit hard by the opioid crisis, Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood.
I've spent a lot of time reporting in Kensington. It's an area reeling from opioid overdoses, drug deals, and homelessness. Outside an elevated train station, people sit on the stairs with their heads buried in their arms. Others hustle for spare change or sell works. That's street slang for a syringe. And some stand in a stooped posture, their bodies drooping and then jerking back up again in the rhythm of a heroin nod. Cano Gomez, who lives around here, is smoking a cigarette and watching an ambulance wind its way through traffic.
It's like watching TV. You stand here, it's like watching a whole reality show, 1 hour reality show, every time you stand out here. I'm telling you, man, it's crazy.
For people addicted on the streets, overdosing is just one worry on a long list of hardships. Many have lost their homes, jobs, and families. They've seen friends die and get locked up. And when they try to explain how all of this happened, they often say something like this.
I'm a freaking addict. I mean, I got disease, man, so.
And no matter who is talking about addiction, these days, chances are they're using this term, disease.
A disease that we too often just whisper about, the disease of addiction.
The disease of addiction.
The ugly disease of addiction.
After years of fighting a war on drugs, policymakers on both sides of the aisle now talk about addiction as a public health issue.
This epidemic is a national health emergency.
But this way of looking at addiction as a brain disease and not a bad life choice is still fairly new. I met one of the scientists who laid the groundwork for this idea on the other side of Philadelphia, at the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Studies of Addiction.
This is my little office there.
Charles O'Brien has been doing addiction research since the 1960s. He says back then, psychiatrists tended to view drug addicts as essentially psychopaths.
It was related to antisocial personality, and that's not really true.
They did know that the body could become dependent on a drug over time. But with new technologies, Charles and his colleagues were able to see the impact drugs had on the brain.
Beginning in the 1980s, we started doing brain imaging, and we developed cues that were associated with drug use.
The cues were pictures of things like a syringe jabbed into a forearm. Charles showed these pictures to people who had a history of addiction and scanned their brains, and the effects were astounding.
People thought that I was giving drugs to my patients in the laboratory, and I wasn't. All I was doing was showing them pictures.
The pictures were enough to activate areas of the brain that form the reward system. the same areas that would light up if a person had, say, snorted a line of cocaine.
Drugs like heroin or alcohol can take over that system. People use the term hijack.
The reward system is the brain circuitry that gives us a motivating hit of pleasure when we get the things we need to survive. Things like food, sex, and social connection. But drugs deliver a reward that's much more powerful than these so-called natural rewards. When someone becomes addicted, the drug rewards begin to drown out the natural rewards, and the brain gets wired to seek the drug above anything else. Charles' brain imaging research revealed one very important way the brain gets rewired. People develop a conditioned response to things they associate with their drug use that mimics the effects of getting high. So even just the sight of a needle or a bottle could trigger powerful cravings that can make it almost irresistible to start using again, even long after someone gets clean.
They relapse because it's still in their brain.
His finding helped explain the hallmarks of addiction, how people almost always relapse and keep using drugs despite the often devastating personal costs. The work provided a scientific basis for calling addiction a brain disease. And neuroscientists continue to build on this discovery, trying to understand the complicated and sometimes unexpected ways that addiction affects the brain. In a basement laboratory at the University of Pennsylvania, psychiatrist Daniel Langleben is using a giant fMRI machine to look inside the brains of people recovering from addiction.
So this is the control room, basically, of the 3 Tesla whole body MRI scanner.
There's somebody inside, but all I can see are her legs sticking out from a dark tunnel. It definitely feels a bit like a place where aliens would take somebody they'd abducted.
What is that beeping noise?
These are the gradients of the MRI scanner. This basically means that the MRI scanner is running.
The woman inside is 25 years old and a mom who's in recovery from opioid addiction. Daniel's team is showing her a bunch of different baby photos while the machine scans her brain.
The task involves you being asked to either rate how cute is the baby or to what extent you would like to take care of it.
These cute babies can activate the same part of the brain's reward system that lights up when people use drugs.
Specifically, it's called nucleus accumbens. It's a very, very small area deep inside the brain.
Daniel says research suggests that our brains are wired to get a motivating hit of pleasure just from seeing baby schema.
The hypothesis is that it is made to be rewarding exactly because nature needs us to take care of the young.
Brain research seems to explain so many aspects of addiction, from cravings and relapse to neglecting responsibilities like childcare. That's helped move our understanding of addiction out of the realm of morality and into the medical world as a disease that can be treated. Scientists say that's reduced stigma and brings better treatments to people. One result is that the federal government is spending billions of dollars on things like medication-assisted treatment to alleviate the opioid crisis. But the brain disease definition of addiction has a lot of critics.
When I hear the term brain disease, it sounds a lot like Alzheimer's, and that's often how it's been analogized.
Sally Satel is a psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., and a lecturer at Yale Medical School. She's on board with all the neuroscience on addiction, but she still takes issue with calling it a brain disease. Sally says getting addicted isn't like catching an infection or a defect that spontaneously appears in the brain.
From a psychological standpoint, from the question of motivation, you know, why do you have Alzheimer's? It's meaningless. If I were to ask you why you drink too much, why you're using heroin every day, that's a meaningful question. And it goes to the fact that people use drugs for reasons.
And that makes her skeptical that medication is really enough to help people stay in recovery.
Medication can help stabilize people so that they're not in withdrawal. They may crave less, but a lot of people still want to alter their consciousness. They're in a lot of psychic pain.
Third Avenue in Manhattan. I've come to New York to see Maya Solovitz, who's trying to reconcile these two sides of addiction, its roots in both biology and behavior. Maya is a journalist who's been covering addiction for 30 years. She was also addicted to drugs herself when she was in college. She writes about this in her book, Unbroken Brain.
Is the title kind of a double entendre of a Grateful Dead song?
Yes, it is. And you are one of the few people who have actually gotten that, but it is indeed the case, and I am a deadhead. I had sort of had the kind of hippie attitude of, like, white powders are bad, but, you know, Jerry offers you a line, you're going to do it.
The Jerry she's talking about is Jerry Garcia. You know, the front man of the group? The line he offered her was Maya's first time trying cocaine at age 17. A few years later, she got busted for cocaine possession. That was a wake-up call. She entered treatment and began her recovery. Maya says she can't blame Jerry for all this, though. She'd already experimented with other substances at that point. The druggy music scene she was a part of in the 80s gave her a sense of identity, and the chemicals themselves relieved her social anxiety.
Generally, 90% of addictions happen in the teen and young adult, or they begin at that time, and that's a sensitive period of brain development.
For Maya, addiction is not so much a brain disease, but fundamentally about learning. So say somebody is on morphine after surgery.
It's a kind of funny thing, but there are people who become physically dependent on opioids in the hospital for pain, and they don't know it. And they go home, and they feel like they have the flu, and they're like, oh, this sucks, and then they go on with their lives, and they never realized that they had a physical dependence on an opioid. If you don't learn that a drug fixes some kind of problem for you, you can't be addicted to it because you wouldn't know what to crave.
Maya says the way that addictive behaviors are learned isn't given enough weight when we label addiction a brain disease. She thinks it should take center stage. The gist of her argument takes us back to those cute baby photos. Maya says the connection between opioid addiction and the way we can become obsessed with a cute baby is key to the story of what addiction really is. It's the same with other human relationships. A lover's touch, a friend's reassuring presence, a happy baby cradled in your arms. All of these are rewarded by naturally occurring opioid neurotransmitters in the brain.
What opioids do in the brain when they're not sort of relieving pain is they are there to create social bonds.
And when we don't abandon an infant that throws up on us and cries through the night, or continue to chase a love interest after a crushing rejection, Maya points out that these behaviors look a lot like addiction.
People with addiction are persisting despite negative consequences in a way that's necessary for human survival. We evolved this thing for a reason, because it's like hard to deal with people, and babies are a pain in the butt, and they cry, and you have to change them, and you have to persist if you are going to survive and reproduce successfully, right?
In addiction, she says, people have learned to love the wrong rewards. And Maya says to understand why people want to alter their experience with chemicals, you have to look outside the brain.
Trauma is one of the other big factors. About 2/3 of people with addiction have at least one childhood trauma.
There's also important socioeconomic factors.
Unemployment, poverty, kind of being socially disconnected. And there are very few people with addiction that have none of those elements.
Maya says the way we talk about addiction now as a brain disease misses the mark.
I just want people to understand that this is a learned behavior in which a system that is there for essential survival and reproduction stuff goes in the wrong direction. It's not an inhuman behavior. It's not about evil, manipulative, horrible, lying people.
She says it's not so much the words that matter, but what exactly we mean when we call addiction a disease.
That story was reported by Joel Wolfram, and it was made possible in part thanks to a grant from the Scattergood Foundation for Behavioral Health. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about what we call things and why it matters. Sometimes a scientific term becomes so popular that it loses its meaning. One example is nano. It's a prefix meaning 1 billionth, so a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. But now we see it pop up in all kinds of product names. I went online, I found a nano wallet, a nano mask, there's a nano knife, nano everything. And that's annoying some people. Alan Yu reports.
Last year, tech billionaire Elon Musk of SpaceX and Tesla got into a bizarre social media argument with two scientists. He tweeted, "Ahem, you have nano in your bio. That is 100% synonymous with BS." In the midst of the Twitter spat, he seemed to be dismissing the entire field of nanotechnology.
which I think is crazy because we know that both Tesla and SpaceX are powered on nanotechnology.
That's Michelle Dickinson. She's a nanotechnologist. It's her job, a real thing. Michelle works on materials 100,000 times smaller than the width of human hair. One of her projects was making artificial nanohairs kind of like those on a gecko's feet. They let geckos stick to all sorts of surfaces. Michelle jumped into the argument after Elon Musk tweeted at Australian molecular biologist Upali Divisekara.
According to his perception, the word nanotech is hype that hasn't shown any promise and hasn't shown any sort of real product development.
Upali, she's a nanotechnologist too, was a little surprised to hear that all the work she and her colleagues were doing was BS, according to the tech billionaire. But she concedes the term for her very real work has become this vague buzzword.
The term nano is probably overused as much as the term micro was overused in the past, to the point that it became almost, meaningless.
We had microprocessors in microcomputers and toys called micronauts and micro machines. It's like nano is the new micro. Here's Steve Jobs introducing the iPod Nano on stage in 2005.
This is the new iPod Nano.
So I blame Apple and their iPod Nano. That's where it all started.
But Michelle Dickinson says plenty has come out of real nanotechnology work. Sunscreen used to leave a white tint. Now, you rub the sunscreen on your skin and it disappears.
All we've done is made the particles smaller to the nanoscale, which means your eye can't see them.
Nanotechnology gives stained glass its red and yellow color, and nanoparticles in car tires make them more durable. And Upali Divisekara, she applies her nano skills to cancer research. She's working on nanoparticles of gold that could ferry drugs directly to cancer cells.
There's always a lot of hype in the beginning, depending on how it's perceived in the media. And then people sort of get a bit bored and go, well, where's all the stuff we were promised? And it's like, well, this is research.
Upali says the amazing stuff that we dreamed of is real. And she's working on it. But science takes time.
That's Alan Yu reporting. Lots of words and terms from science make their way into our everyday language, stuff like orbit or exponential. And when we lay people use these terms incorrectly, it can be a pet peeve for scientists. Jess Walcott teaches biology and neuroscience. Her thing, your hot take on how your lucky socks made the Eagles win?
No, señor! Los Eagles se
van! Don't call that a theory.
In science, when we talk about theories, we mean that there's a lot of evidence to back it up. It's not something that you came up with one day and said, oh, I think this might be what's going on. That's actually a hypothesis, something that you can actually test, and it's your idea for what might be happening. In the general population, people tend to use theory to mean, I have a theory about this, and it drives me crazy.
If you want to annoy ecologist Adam Langley, overuse the word massive.
The Pacific Ocean is massive. Black holes are massive. But people now seem to use it just for general bigness, even for abstract entities. We got into a massive argument. In my opinion, it's a massive breach of diction to use it in this way. And I get massively upset when it's used as an amplifying adverb. See what I did there?
All right. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about what we call things and why it matters. We reached out to scientists and we asked them what terms we all use in our everyday language, incorrectly, that drive them crazy. Here's biologist Samantha Chapman. She says the stuff in a flower pot or in your garden that you put your tomatoes in, don't call it dirt.
Dirt is what you wipe off of your child's face or clean off of your floor. Soil is the living, breathing matrix that harbors an interconnected plethora of bacteria, fungi, and tiny animals. Soil grows our food, it cleans our water, and it mediates our climate. Soil is alive, and it's useful, and really, it's the lifeblood of our planet. Soil is not dirt.
And here's neurologist Roy Hamilton. He wants people to stop saying that the left side of the brain is the logical and rational half, and the right side of the brain is the creative and artistic half.
Folks, you use both halves of your brain for both categories of tasks. Now, there is some degree of functional separation between the two halves of the brain. For example, the left side tends to have a dominant role in language. The right side tends to have a bigger role in visual spatial processing. But the idea that there's a left-sided robot brain and a right-sided artiste brain that are living side by side, that's just neurologic folklore. Thanks.
All right, got it. Our last story is about something we say as a compliment, but it's not always appreciated. Many parents who have daughters don't want people to call their girls beautiful or pretty. What's that about? Christine Fennessy has more.
Guess what? I was actually on the radio once, and we were singing French. What? I used to go to French school.
That's 5-year-old Livia Carlson. She lives near Seattle. Livia is an outgoing kid who loves learning about dinosaurs and playing with her puppy, Raisin. She is also a stunning girl. She has big blue eyes and the kind of hair you see in magazines. Golden ringlets that, according to her mom, Liz Reap Carlson, attract a lot of attention.
People are always saying, "That hair, where did you get those blonde locks?"
They also tell Livia how pretty she is. It happens everywhere. In the grocery store, at the post office, the pharmacy. Liz's gut reaction?
Really, this again, the hair?
Liz doesn't actually say that. She says thank you. She knows people are trying to be friendly. And she knows how it sounds, like, woe is me, I have to field my daughter's compliments all day. But those compliments do worry her.
And I'm at home trying to teach her about how important it is to write and to read and to pursue things that she's curious about and ask questions. But what society constantly reinforces is that she looks pretty and that her hair is nice.
It's tough to know exactly how all the attention affects Livia, but she does not like getting her hair cut.
She's learned very early on that it's an asset, which is not such a bad thing, I suppose, but she has learned that when she dresses up, she gets a lot more attention. I do think it has an impact on her. It makes her a lot more aware of her appearance.
Liz recently cut Livia's hair. It took 2 days of negotiating. But Livia's happy with her new bob. And that's all Liz wants, a happy, confident kid. She knows what can happen when happiness and confidence rely on appearance. When Liz was growing up, she got lots of compliments on her looks. The more attention she paid to her clothes and her hair, the more praise she got. She came to believe that nothing mattered as much as being pretty. Eventually, for her, pretty came to mean thin, very thin.
I went into the hospital in college because I was afraid I was going to die. At that point, I was 19 and I had been actively anorexic or bulimic for 7 years.
She knows her experience makes her super sensitive to what people say to Livia. But she also thinks that focusing on Livia's appearance sells her kids short. She would love if conversations with Livia expanded to something like,
"Wow, I really like that you have jungle print on. What's your favorite color? Is there a jungle animal that you love the most? Or tell me a little bit more about what you're up to. I see you got your soccer cleats on. You know, or what grade are you in? You look like you're about, what's a 5-year-old into these days?"
I asked some other parents if their girls get compliments for their appearance and how they feel about it.
My name is Jung Kim Cleese. I don't really like word like beautiful or gorgeous. I tell my daughter, "You look so strong," or "You look so healthy." I think cutie beauty comes from the inside.
And here's Richard Allen. He has 2 daughters, and he says how he reacts when people call them beautiful depends on who it is.
If it's someone who knows them, I feel like they should really try harder. Because if they have a relationship with my girls, I would like them to make comments based on the interactions that they've had with my girls. But if it's someone who's meeting them for the first time and they say that, I don't get offended. Frankly, I think they're right.
But many psychologists believe that appearance-based comments are harmful. When kids are constantly praised for being beautiful, they can develop what's called a fixed mindset. Basically, they start to believe their value is dependent on their looks. And so all their time and energy go into maintaining that value. And if those compliments stop coming, they can feel like a failure.
excited on this.
That's 6-year-old Adeline Taylor. She's showing me her painting.
So it's like a forest with, and these yellow spots are actually fireflies. Uh-huh. And this is actually a shooting star. Like, I wanted to do that to add, and it's windy in the nighttime.
So it's a very cool nightscape of bare brown trees surrounded by fireflies. It's kind of Van Gogh-ish. Adeline comes by her talent naturally. Her mom, Tricia Samuel, is an art teacher and an artist herself.
In the fine art world, I do portraits. And my favorite is to do people. There's just something really beautiful about looking at someone's portrait and seeing how extraordinarily unique they are.
Tricia also has a son, Marshall, who's almost 3. Like his sister, he's a good-looking kid, and he loves to talk. And when he's out, people notice.
It was very interesting to realize that he was getting the same amount of attention. And I don't know, I think maybe stereotypically I thought that only a girl would get those beautiful comments, but he gets them just as often.
The comments typically come from older women. And while Tricia supports those who advocate against labeling kids like that, she understands why it happens. She's an artist. She gets it. We live in a visual culture. We're almost hardwired to comment on things we enjoy looking at. She also sees these comments as an opportunity for a more meaningful interaction.
I think the reason that I don't get upset is that I just feel like our purpose in life is to connect with each other. So I don't want to shame people into changing. I want to connect with them and, you know, grow together. That's what I want to do.
Still, she knows such words can be fraught. She remembers the insecurity she felt growing up, of thinking she didn't look good enough. She remembers relying too much on other people to make her feel okay with herself. So she works hard to explain to her kids that beauty glows from the inside. And so far, Adeline seems to get it. When people say she's beautiful, she thanks them. She thinks it's so nice. She says, it's really fun for me. But when they don't say anything about how she looks?
Yeah, I kind of like just roll with it. Because that's what 6-year-olds do.
That story was reported by Christine Fennessy. And that's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Andreas Copes is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lizarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.